It all started with one little mouse. But today, Disney is a cultural behemoth, a global household name. Disney means childhood, nostalgia, and joy. But recently, their multi-billion dollar empire has grown with a string of high profile and big money acquisitions. So, is the magic still there? And why does everyone love Disney? Welcome to America, a history podcast. I'm Liam Heffernan, and every week we answer a different question to understand the people, the places, and the events that make the USA what it is today. Joining me to answer this question is an author and professor in communication research at the University of Oregon, whose book Understanding Disney was a huge resource for me during my time as an American studies student. So a huge welcome to the show, Janet Wasko.
Thank you very much. It's really excellent to be with you.
Yeah, it's a genuine highlight for me to have you on the podcast. So I cannot wait to dive into all things Disney. But, you know, I think a good starting point for us is the fact that I read your first edition, which was published way back in 2001, and unfortunately dates how long ago I was studying, but nonetheless, it was a great book for its time. Your second edition came out in 2020. I imagine you've had a lot to update in that time.
Yes, it turned out I did. I initially think there would be that much. They bought a few companies and so forth, but really the extent of their expansion really prompted some not necessarily total rethinking of arguments and so forth, but a little bit of reworking the way that we think about the company these days, and also to make sure that in the book, at least, I tried to insist that the whole historical coverage, a story of Disney is very important to understand, because, for instance, people these days think it's always been a major, major company, one of the major studios in Hollywood. It hasn't. So that history, I think, is significant to understand the saga of Disney's success, popularity, and so forth. And then as we look also at the kinds of films and programming that the company is distributing these days, rethinking also needs to be done in terms of the representation, for instance, of women, of minorities, and so forth. So all of that meant that it took longer than I thought it would.
And actually, I remember The Princess and the Frog was quite groundbreaking for Disney at the time, because if I remember correctly, I think that was the first time that Disney had introduced a non-white princess into its canon. And that was a right. huge deal. And that was only 2009, I believe. So that was right. quite recent, right. really.
Right, right. And that got picked up in other kinds of representation, even of the, you know, white princesses, if we can call them that, because there were some changes in terms of the way they made decisions and their ability to just make their own decisions about their lives, looking past just finding a prince. In other words, my students and others assume now that Disney has empowered women through that reworking of the princesses, in addition to, of course, introducing a more diverse princesses. My argument is that a lot is the same, but that whole shift, I feel, needed some additional attention. So that took a while to kind of sort out.
Yeah, and thinking about, you know, how much Disney has changed, particularly in the last few years, you know, and I think potentially the sort of change of leadership at the top has driven quite a commercialized mindset in the way that Disney have operated. but I guess it's sort of reflected in the type of films that they're making, you know, in everything that they're doing. Do you think that that magic that we came to know and love about Disney is sort of fading away a little bit?
It's interesting to try to answer that question, because I think it's both. There are those who still are very, very attached to, beyond that, love Disney. And I think there are plenty of those people still around. On the other hand, there has been kind of a pushback in terms of, for instance, some of their acquisitions. Some Super Marvel fans and Star Wars fans have been disappointed. They worried to begin with, and have been disappointed with the way that Disney's managed those brands, those whatever you want to call them, universes. So they've lost some of their avid fans, I think, but still there are enough people who still feel very strongly about the Disney brand, and it's very difficult to convince them that you know, things haven't changed so much, and they really they're very avid in terms of their fandom. I call that, there are still huge numbers, who knows how many, of people who might be called fanatics, Disney fanatics, and I've been criticized for calling them that, but that's what they call themselves. These are people who organize their life around Disney. They get married in a Disney wedding, possibly at one of the parks. They, you know, all of their birthdays, of course, are Disney themed. Their houses are covered with Disney products, and go on and on and on and on. It's their life is, you know, really defined by Disney, and there's some real fanatics. And then there are also just massive numbers of fans, as you can tell by just going online, putting in Disney, and the kind of fan material is amazing. It's grown so much. So it's still there, but it's like both. There are those who think they've lost the magic, and they're very vocal about that. But then there are others that still think that they've got it and are still big fans.
Yeah, and I think we'll come on to Disney adults in a minute, because I think that's definitely the people you're referring to. But I kind of leading into that, I wonder if one of the reasons that people grow up to be so attached to the Disney brand, particularly the core Disney brand, is because it's become so synonymous with childhood. There's something very nostalgic about it, and then there's something very aspirational about it as we grow up. Do you think that's still the case, or do you think over the years maybe that's become a little bit watered down?
I think it's still very much alive. There are those of us who grew up with Disney and have very wonderful memories of the films, of the theme parks, and so forth, and pass them down to their children. And it's almost like it's just required that you do that. And then that just keeps on happening. Historically, that I think is one of the reasons why Disney remains so popular. That connection with childhood and the experiences of Disney products and services in childhood, they're not always totally happy for everyone, but mostly they are, and they're remembered as, you know, as positively, and then passed on over the years, over the generations. It continues. I think the current kind of response to some of the political issues relating to Disney may indeed pass. I don't know. It certainly is taking a hit in terms of in some ways, but I think that I had this sense that it will continue. The company will continue its success and popularity in various ways, which we could talk about some more.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up that side of it, and that's something that we've addressed in a previous episode when we've been talking about Ron DeSantis, actually, and sort of how Disney's been dragged into politics a bit. Off the back of that, it's actually really interesting, because you know, you've got people that are fully grown adults and yet they still have this borderline obsession with Disney. And yet they know that there's more to Disney than that. They know that the magic is to some degree just a facade. You know, it's bells and whistles in a theme park and whatnot. You know, they can see the stuff that's going on politically. They can see the business that lies behind it. So why do people continue to just give all of their money to Disney?
I ask the same question. And certainly I grew up with Disney and grew up in Southern California, enjoyed, loved to go to Disneyland and so forth. So I have to say that I'm among the majority who really feel very nostalgic about Disney in their childhood. And I think that's one of the reasons why it continues as one grows up. You know, you may get away from it for a while, but then come back to it. But it's that those memories and that nostalgia and so forth is part of it. But I also think that, again, to go back to the way that Walt Disney talked about the theme parks and so forth, Disneyland, is that it wasn't just for children. And if we look at the whole company today, it's definitely not just for children. It's for families, hopefully, often. And that's a theme that is promoted by the company, family. But you look across their holdings, across what I'm calling now Disney a multiverse, because it owns a lot of other universes. But if you look across that, there are products, services, and so forth that aren't just for children. There are, you know, franchises, even though certainly Star Wars, Marvel, is enjoyed by children, but also through adults. And that's, so I think it's a little bit of a misconception to say it's only aimed at children. They aim at everyone. They aim for everyone. And very deliberate in terms of developing and strengthening their, the demographics of their audiences and their consumers. So beyond that, also, if we look also at the whole Disney adult concept, which is, I think, relatively recent, also that whole notion of staying young, being young, I think maybe it's one of the motivations when someone puts on a Mickey Mouse t-shirt or sweatshirt. You know, people will think of me as young at heart, and so there's that, because we're always concerned about youth and, you know, staying young and wild and crazy and you know, unique and everything else that goes along with that. Identifying with Disney for some people, I believe, represents that, a kind of staying young. And also maybe as an adult, well, you don't expect me to be childish, but here I like to have fun. Look, here's Mickey Mouse on my chest. So some of these issues about why Disney is popular, I think, are somewhat complex. Lots different people being fans or fanatics for various reasons, as well as other reasons why I think that Disney remains popular. The strategies and tactics they use are not sometimes unique, but sometimes they are in terms of maintaining that popularity.
Yeah, and
go into those also.
Let's touch on that, because one of the things I remember that really stuck with me when I read Understanding Disney is that I was really surprised when I read it, when you broke down the company's kind of revenue streams. And actually, that's when it dawned on me that the films, the TV, the content is really just a gateway to get people into the parks, to experience Disney in all its glory, right? So there is something quite deliberate and actually, you know, quite ruthless about that.
Yeah. I think the word deliberate is really an important word here. I think, yeah, to the content, of course, it is important. in various ways, and lots of analysts deal with, you know, doing that content analysis or and looking at the ways that Disney represents and what themes and, you know, what kind of emotions and so forth are encouraged. But also it's that deliberateness in terms of getting people to feel good about the Disney name, but also continue to promote that kind of classic Disney in a way. And it's not accidental. I think one of the things that I find the most interesting is that the words used by everyone seem to be relatively the same. We did a study a few years back, a Global Disney Audience Project in about 20 countries or something, and confirmed that people use very, very similar words to describe Disney. And you know them: magic, family, imagination, right? Those, happiness. Those aren't accidental, I don't think. They're used by the company constantly in everything they do. And if you start looking not just at the ads, but the promotion, other kinds of material that is produced, it's that constant repetition of those key terms. And I ask my students when I teach the class on Disney about how they would describe Disney before I even say anything in the class, and they come up with those same words, of course. So it's deliberate by the company. And I think that also another strategy they use and have for many years is to celebrate the memories, celebrate everything. Every year there are various celebrations, the anniversary of now we're in the 100th year of the company, right? But also there's a celebration of Walt's birthday, there's a celebration of Mickey Mouse's creation, there's the it goes on and on and on. And it's a major promotional point, not just at the parks, but that's big at the parks, but also in the promotion of the films with various kinds of images promoted in the trailers and so forth, the such and such anniversary of something. It's a way of promoting, instilling this kind of notion that Disney continues year after year after year, which it does. But I think it's a way of continuing to get people's attention and telling them what to think and how to think about Disney. I hope I hit some of the points.
It's got me thinking, because everything that you've said sounds correct, but there's something there that makes me think they're almost making their jobs harder, because they're starting to bring in these other brands into the fold. You know, they've bought Star Wars and Marvel and the Muppets, and they're now integrating that into the theme parks and within the Disney identity. Right. So I find it really fascinating that even today, when you ask people to define Disney, they use words like magic and family and happiness. How do you think that they're able to bring all of these other universes into the fold and still protect that core Disney brand?
I think sometimes it works very well. Some of those brands are the ones that are boosting various demographic groups. I mean, you know, bringing in Marvel brought in more boys, more men, for instance. But also the way that they're promoting them. And one could probably look more carefully at some of the films that they've done since they bought those, obtained those brands, and how they've been, you know, reworked slightly. That's a problem for some fans too, of course. But I think that they try to put that kind of magic across all of what they own. But also, I don't think they're so worried about, for instance, having to brand ESPN as magic. You know, it's there, it's got audiences. There are other, you know, other issues with it, of course. But I think the diversity also works for them, of course. In fact, the whole notion of those various components working together is well known and called Disney synergy. And this is not accidental that they cross the various, you know, services, products, and so forth. Mickey Mouse appears on ESPN and so forth and so forth. Synergy, different parts working together for the whole, right? It's not accidental. They have specific people at the company who are directors of synergy. I mean, it's a job. So that's not accidental. And that's also another way that, you know, one brand or franchise may be doing well and others may not, but they kind of cover for each other in a classic kind of synergistic way. And Disney has been known to do that best. Other studios keep trying and have tried, but that cross promotion is also bringing the different parts together. I think that judging from my students, some of them have different responses in terms of what the magic means. And they would associate something like the Marvel films also can be magical and so forth. So and the other thing that to point out that not everyone loves Disney. And my students don't believe that, some of them, but some of them don't love Disney, but increasingly fewer, I think. There are people who don't care at all about the Disney companies. And to fanatics, that's, you know, it's impossible. You know, it's their world, their universe. So there's that point to make as well. It's not uniformly received as magical and even imaginative.
And I guess though Disney have been aware of that, not just recently, but for quite a while, because I mean it's more obvious now because buying Star Wars and Marvel and Fox are very high profile acquisitions. But you touched on ESPN. That's not a new thing. You know, that's been decades for Disney. ABC. You know, ABC there as well, but also I believe Touchstone Pictures, which little known to anyone else, was a Disney studio and produced much more adult content, horrors and thrillers. You know,
yes, it was deliberately created for that.
Yeah,
and in the 80s, and by, you know, when Michael Eisner took over and really made a lot of changes in terms of those kinds of issues. But Touchstone is only one example. They also owned Miramax.
Yeah, of course.
Yes. And that's the example of how that was just way too out of, at the moment, at the time, the Disney universe. I mean, that just didn't fit. They had problems.
I mean, that's definitely something they want to distance themselves from now, right?
Yeah. Even though, there's a place for more adult-oriented programs, I think, in Disney, but they're just not known for it. And a lot of times people don't even know that they do own ESPN, by the way. So it's often the case that people don't know everything they own. And these days, it's hard to keep up with it.
And I guess it was more discreet back then. I think there was, I feel like there was a more concerted effort by Disney to separate stuff that was Disney branded and stuff that wasn't. Yeah. Whereas now there's a blurring of the lines more, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. And because they also, as you note, over the last couple of decades, since 2000, they have added so much. And especially ever since they finally took over Pixar, which they totally own now, and then added the other big brands, Marvel, Star Wars, Lucas, and then all the Fox shows. What about the Fox shows? The television
programming. Huge acquisition.
That criticizes Disney.
Yeah.
So there's all of that I think has drawn much more attention to the company. It now is assumed that I hear people say all the time that it monopolizes Disney. It certainly is very dominant these days in terms of what they own. But in any one year, one studio will make more money than another. But Disney has really a huge part of the market these days. And so it's getting more attention because of that, too.
Yeah, definitely. And I, for one, since the Fox acquisition, have been keeping my fingers crossed for some sort of Disney Family Guy mashup, which maybe one day, maybe one day.
Well, there are they've done shows kind of critiquing or Disney already and Family Guy. So, but it was before.
They were a lot more a lot harsher towards Disney back then, weren't they? But I guess before we wrap up, and it feels very premature doing so, because we could talk for hours more about everything to do with Disney, but
I think we could.
But I just want to end by getting your personal opinion. You know, what's your favorite and least favorite thing about Disney, and why?
It's interesting. I often, when I either teach classes or talk about Disney, I don't totally focus on kind of negative aspects, although I just try to point out what all they own and some of their strategies and influence and so forth and so forth. And to hopefully get people to think of, to understand it, the company and the phenomenon more seriously. And especially in my class, I don't come right out and say I hate Disney or all of the critiques, because I have a lot of them. But I think that, first of all, going back and saying again, I grew up with Disney, of course, and worked there for a while at the studio, very, very, very short time. And the way that they have developed, you know, not just animation, but other technologies that relate to media and other aspects of entertainment. I mean, you have to just step back and go, wow, that's amazing. And some of the films and other kinds of activities I still enjoy. I have, and I won't name those that I do, but on the other hand, I have a hard time watching them sometimes, because everything comes back in terms of how their strategies promote commercialization. And I'm especially concerned, as we all are, in terms of environmental and ecological issues. And the theme parks, I could go on, I'll stop right there, but the theme park is in a real challenge. They are doing all kinds of green kinds of activities, but it's still bringing massive numbers of people getting on planes and going to somewhere. And I mean, it's just, it's hard to acknowledge that they're not contributing to problems in terms of ecology and environment. So those are some of the things, and I could go on about the critiques I have, but generally I also have to respect people's sincere emotions and attitudes about Disney, and not, I don't think that I want to just totally say it should not exist, but I'm relatively critical of it. So.
And well, maybe one day, actually, to address the green issue, everything will be VR anyway. So no one will be traveling anywhere, right?
That's right. And they are working on that. They have a research unit that's working on all kinds of technologies that may lead us there if we aren't partially there already. Some people are.
Yeah, well, that of course, Disney are. Of course they are. And finally, quick fire question. What is your favorite Disney film? Because everyone has one.
Boy. Well, I can say my favorite Marvel film is Doctor Strangelove.
That counts.
Oh, I know. Sorry, no, Doctor Strange.
Yes. Right. Yes, two very different films.
Yes, right. Oops. is one of my top films. But also, if I go historically to the classic Disney films, I think Pinocchio gets overlooked a lot because the princesses dominate, but Pinocchio is an amazing film, and I think what Guillermo del Toro did was also amazing, another version of it, but I think that some of the that gets overlooked. There are others, but I'll not keep going.
This episode of America, a history podcast, was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Liam Heffernan. A special thanks to my guest this week, Janet Wasko, for her expert knowledge on all things Disney. And if you like this episode, do check out some of the resources, including Janet's book, in the show notes. Now, normally I say next time and plug the next episode, but we're going to take a very short break from the podcast, only for a month or so, and come back with a bit of a refresh and a rebrand. So bear with us. There'll be a trailer and maybe one or two little bonus bits between now and then. But do keep in touch. Email hello@podcastsbyliam.com. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, and suggest a guest or an episode for us to include in future. So until we return, speak soon and enjoy our back catalogue.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.